What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? Close observers, who through words and images, strive to capture the details in fiction, history, art, and song. These are conversations from the pointed firs, invoking the spirit of place with artists and authors from Maine.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Laureen Labar, archaeologist, historian, and recently retired curator at the Maine State Museum in Augusta. Laurie is a graduate of anthropology from the University of Vermont, with a graduate degree from the Distinguished Winter Tour Program in Early American Culture, University of Delaware. We are discussing her book, Maine Quilts, 250 Years of Comfort and Community, published in 2021 by Down East Books. Her research interests are broad: American decorative arts, including furniture, metals, textiles, and ceramics, Civil War flags, Indian trade silver, and prehistoric textile and ceramic technology. During her years at the museum, she has curated multiple permanent and temporary exhibits to include Uncommon Thread, Wabanaki Textiles, Clothing and Costume at Home in Maine, and to the Highest Standard Maine Civil War's Flag. Welcome, Laurie, to Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Thank you, Peter. It's wonderful to be here.
So great. How is your retirement?
I'm not completely sure yet because I've spent most of it cooking and cleaning, as one does in the fall.
So you've been 20 years a professional and you haven't cleaned the house once?
It's Not once.
Not
once for a little while, yes.
Yeah, right. We have a challenge today. It's unlike any other Conversations from the Pointed Firs edition yet, because we're going to be talking about something we cannot see. And so we have to talk about it as an abstraction, but at the same time make it come alive and be relevant and accessible to our listeners. So as we go forward, we need to ask each other and our listeners to imagine. Think of the quilts you've seen at any given time. You'll recognize some of the patterns and things that we talk about, and see if you can envision this unique art form and also contextualize it through our conversation. So before we begin, tell me about you, where you came from, how you got here, how you found this interest, etc.
Well, I'm from all over the place. Mm-hmm. My family lived in seven states and multiple places within some of those states. So, and then we lived in several countries when I was growing up, too. So we came to Maine for a couple of years, 1 year in Bangor, 1 year in Orono when I was a teenager. Absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. And then we moved on to Vermont, which I also loved, but I really wanted to come back to Maine, and I did. I came back to Maine in 1984 for a four-week archaeological project, and I never left.
How did you know that you wanted to dig? How did you know you wanted to dig in the earth for old things?
Well, in part because of all the moving we did. There was the way I fell in love with museums was there was a field school when I was probably second or third grade in Montana, and in this Museum of the Rockies, there was a huge room that had a full-size teepee and a whole bunch of material culture from the Blackfoot, and I wound up being separated from my group, I think because I was so mesmerized by the material I was seeing. And the docent said, "Little girl, if you promise not to touch anything, you can go in there." And that was it. I was in love with museums. And then we went to live in Mexico, where every other hill has a flat top, and you know it's not just a hill. And on it went. So that's where I wound up.
Did your parents encourage you, this digging in the dirt for dinosaur bones?
Well, it wasn't dinosaurs, of course. It was all anthropological. Mm-hmm. And they just encouraged us to study what we loved because that was their path and it worked for them.
Mm-hmm. And how did you follow or define a professional path?
Well, I was very lucky. I started working there were a couple months that were dicey when one graduates from college. That's a little terrifying. But and then I came to do archaeology. I knew people. I'd worked on as to help with digs when I was in college. And so I wound up working for something called CRM, Cultural Resource Management, which is if there's it's all federally funded and licensed projects, they have to have archaeological work done as part of their environmental impact statement. And then when in 92, there was an economic downturn, and a bunch of us got laid off. And I wound up a few years later coming to the museum to do some work and discovered the archaeology where you're not doing it for the bottom line. You're not doing a low bid, and it can only – so there would be times where we would be digging, and let's say you're digging for a water system. And so you have to dig right where the water plant is going to be, and you know that – just over there is where the site would probably be, but you can't go over there because that's not part of your grant. And then you go to the museum, and the museum's asking questions and trying to figure out how to answer those questions. And that's a completely different approach to archaeology. And I loved it because there was time to engage the public. There was time to explain things to the public. There was time, a little bit more time to explore. And I really enjoyed that very much and decided that that's what I wanted to do, was to work at a museum. So I went off to grad school, and when I came back, there were two jobs that had opened up in Maine, and I landed the one I wanted and withdrew from the other. And archaeology was actually a very good training ground for what I do now, or what I just did for 20-some-odd years. So I was at the museum for 28 years.
Talk to me a little bit about Winter Tour. I've known a lot of graduates of Winter Tour.
Yes.
It's a very special, somewhat precious place, I think.
Yes. It's a funny place because on the one hand, it was the home of a very, very wealthy man, Henry Francis DuPont. There's about 175 rooms, and each of these rooms is decorated with the most exquisite handmade things that were found in the young United States, and also previously in the colonies. But it's what they do is actually train you to look at objects and try and extract meaning from them. And the focus is on, okay, material culture is a fancy pants way to say stuff. You know, it's just everything that we have and use that's physical is the material culture of our society. So they have you look at these objects, and they, by looking at their decoration, at their form, you can get clues about them and clues to the culture that made them and the culture that used them. And by that, you can start adding voices that might not otherwise be heard to history. So history is generally written history, is the kind of history that tends to be written by white guys. Every now and then you'll get a woman that'll sneak in, but I suspect that neither one of us know very many women from the 1700s or the 1800s, or even the 1900s, the early 1900s that had contributed to Maine history without thinking about it for quite some time. Whereas we can all come up with guys' names because they're the ones that wrote the history. So one of the things about material culture is that you're able to add unheard voices to the conversation, which is, I think, a very worthwhile thing to do.
Before we move on, let me ask you about DuPont. Was he just an addicted acquisitor, or was he a curator at heart?
He was a curator at heart, I would say, but he was definitely an addicted acquisitor as well. As I think anyone who is a curator at heart, if they had that kind of a budget, probably would be. But also at the time he was collecting, times have certainly changed. Today we would never buy an 18th century silk dress so that we could cut it up because there's enough fabric in it to make cover enough chairs for this particular dining room. Mm-hmm. We would never do that today. Mm-hmm. And so there was some of that going on as well.
Well, I was in the museum profession for 20 years. And one of the things I loved about it is that it fed my addiction. So I was welcome at a flea market, but I was also welcome at the auctions because there were other people's funds to be spent. And so you would acquire things and apply your taste. Mm-hmm. And it was actually turned out to be more than I thought, in the sense that it required some knowledge and some responsibility and some kind of vision to essentially put it all together. So now you're at the Maine State Museum in Augusta, undergoing, closed now for a bit.
Yes,
undergoing a massive reorganization, reconstruction. Will it be different when it's finished, or is it just going to be an updated version of the same thing it was before?
We're committed to changing it. A lot of those exhibits needed to get updated, and we simply didn't have the funds or the staff, for that matter. Now what's happening is that our HVAC system died, which is heating and cooling system died. And so one of those things where while you're in there, and they have to get out all of the asbestos, and then, oh, well, while we're in there, let's get some decent windows, because nothing's been upgraded for 50 years, and it was low bid then, of course. So let's get some, oh, hey, how about insulation? And so by the time you add all this, and of course, oh, wait, we have to redo the wiring. Oh, we have to redo the lights. And so it turns into this gigantic, gigantic construction process.
Well, change is tricky.
Yes.
When you set out to find and take these various discovery steps along the way, did you know that, in fact, you're going to have to reinstall all the exhibits and start there?
Oh, no, we did not. This is we've been spending a lot of time trying to get a new exhibit for the entry levels on the third floor. It's very complicated. So the third floor exhibit, the entry level exhibit, will be very different than what people have known for all these years. And the natural science exhibit, you know, it was so old that some of the bird taxidermy mounts were just, we'd just go in and there would be a pile of feathers. Mm-hmm. They would just spontaneously fall apart. Mm-hmm. So those exhibits will be very different. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking about Mainers and welcome to Maine and challenging the stereotypical view of Maine. It's not just lobsters and lighthouses and trying to get people to see some things that they might not get to see ordinarily. And in terms of natural science exhibit, that is now going to be about the Gulf of Maine and with two whale skeletons. So I think people will absolutely love it, but it's going to be a bit of a shock to the system when people first come in. And so we'll be opening just the entry-level floor and the floor above at first. And while we are working like crazy to get the next floors below organized.
Well, many people won't be surprised because they weren't there before.
Yes,
they will
hope.
All see it fresh, which is
yes,
delightful prospect. Yes. I would expect. You were talking about things standing for things, and we talk a lot about metaphors in these conversations. These quilts are they're sort of micro histories, and that in your book is the context in which everything is presented. And they represent domestic economies and family, and particularly the role of women.
They do indeed. And I try to take an approach to look at quilts, historic quilts, from the same lenses that I look at contemporary quilts. So today, I mean, it goes without saying that quilts today are a product of what has come before and the cultural context in which their makers sit. So I tried to do that for the historic quilts as well. And it was really fun because you start to see the ways that quilts reflect what's happening historically. For example, in 1790, over 90% of the Euro-American, that is non-Indigenous, population of Maine, were they were either British or they were the sons or daughters of British people. So it was first and second generations. And if you add the Irish in, then it's over 95%. Mm. So it was very, very British. And the quilts absolutely reflect that. The styles of quilts they're making, even the way that they quilt, the patterns that they use, the way that they finish the edges of the quilts are very British. You see the same patterns and styles that you do in Great Britain. You see designs that are hundreds of years old, and you don't see very much that's cutting edge, but a little bit. And it's fun to sort of see the way that certain things were being made before the Revolution and shortly after the Revolution were being made that were very British. But Americans lost interest in those patterns pretty early, whereas the British kept on making them. So it's fun to sort of see how that also reflects the way that our country started to move forward in its own direction.
You know, I'm sort of surprised. I mean, it seems obvious to me now when you say it, but the British quilting tradition, I don't think I've ever seen a quilt in a British museum ever.
Quilts are textiles, and so textiles don't get exhibited very much mm-hmm. because they're so fragile. Mm-hmm. And anything that's silk, for example, is sensitive to every wavelength of light, and it will absolutely and quite literally turn to dust if it gets too much light on it.
Did Britain have a quilt export trade? Were they exporting quilts as coverlets and blankets?
They were exporting quilts as petticoats. So what we think of as a petticoat, we think of that as underwear, but it was outerwear at the time. It was something that was shown, and it was, so if you lived in a big city, you would probably be buying a silk petticoat that was, they were just so lustrous and soft, just beautiful, and quilted with designs that were interesting. But in Maine, a lot of people made wool petticoats. And they were glazed wool. They were very nice. They had a sheen to them. But, you know, Mainers are a practical lot. And let's get something a little more. So the imported quilts were actually more petticoats than what we would think of as a blanket. And it's something also to know that most of the quilts that were made in the 1700s and very early 1800s in Maine were not bed quilts. They were petticoats. Hmm.
Is it time for a petticoat revival?
We
could start something right here, WERU. It began here, the Great American Petticoat Revival.
That's right.
They were made by individuals,
yes.
But often made by individuals in a circle, a social circle.
It was very common to get people in to help you quilt them. When you're sewing a quilt together, especially if it's in a pieced quilt, which has lots of patchwork, it's really easier to do it yourself. That way, all of the quilt blocks are the same size and they all fit together, for example. So until around 1840, really, the making of the quilt, the piecing of the quilt is a fairly solitary affair. But then you'll probably get your sisters in, maybe the neighbor's girls in, and it'll be something that people will cooperate on. Not always. Sometimes somebody just does it from start to finish. But also, a lot of homes, if you only have one room where everything is happening, it's great to just get a bunch of people in, get this thing quilted, get it done, and get it out of the way so we can have dinner.
Interesting. Were there quilting societies?
Not that I know of.
Were there men quilters?
Not that I know of. Not in this country. There were a few in Great Britain, and we don't tend to have men involved doing a lot of quilting, or at least not that we know of, until the late 1800s.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors and artists who invoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio 89.9 FM, streaming and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Lori Labar about the history of quilts and quilting in Maine as an example of unique craft, history, and social engagement. So each one of them had a message. There was a story in these quilts, either in terms of design and patterns, mm-hmm. which reference various events, or other artistic patterns and perceptions. And then there were political events.
Yes.
And they got incorporated into the quilts over a period of time.
They could. Sometimes the political thing is actually in the fabric. So for our country's centennial, there were all kinds of centennial prints that were produced, and those were incorporated into quilts. Quilts were made, again, this is in the, let me back up a bit, because quilts go from being things which are made for individuals and the family, and then around 1840, there's this new fad, which is making quilts that we call album quilts, or sometimes people call them friendship quilts or sampler quilts. And they're made often to give to someone who's leaving the community, or as a gift of gratitude and friendship, or someone who's getting married, or all these different reasons. There's a whole bunch of different reasons. And also, they were made for fundraisers. So if you were a temperance woman and you wanted to raise money for the cause, you might raffle a quilt and make it together. And then by the time of the Civil War, these groups of women who had been getting together for a cause and sometimes quilting wound up doing the same thing for the Union soldiers. And the quilts that they made were usually either to go to a soldier, and at which point they're to cover a cot, so they're small, single size. Or they were making them to auction them to raise money. And we have a couple examples of those in the Maine State Museum's collection.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Were there historical markers? I mean, there was the Revolutionary War. There was certainly the Civil War. Those were two sort of breakpoints in the history that you talk about.
Yes, they do show events in a subtle way sometimes. For example, the War of 1812. Now, the War of 1812 was an economic calamity for Maine because there was an embargo. Ships couldn't travel. They couldn't get goods from England. If they tried to get goods from France, they were often captured. And so it was really hard to get cottons, for example. Cottons were not produced in the States to any great extent, and they certainly were not produced in Maine at that point. And one of the things we start to see in Maine is we start to see wool-pieced quilts about that time. And we're wondering. We don't have any evidence other than our eyes to suggest that perhaps this was because people wanted to make piece quilts by then. Pieced quilts, let me enunciate that, not piece quilts. But if you can't get cotton, well, heaven knows you can get wool because you can grow it here, you can raise it here, and everybody has warm clothes in Maine. Mm-hmm. So there's always wool.
Isn't it interesting? The cotton was picked here, sent to England, and comes back as textile.
Mm-hmm. The global trade is like that. It does. Yeah. We do that all the time. I was involved once. I went for fun to a mine where I knew some miners. That it was in Western Maine, in Stowe. And after we blew up this corner of the mountain, we got a bunch of gemstones. So they were found in Maine, and then they were going to send them off to Thailand to have them cut, and then send them back to Maine to have them set. Right. So it's the global economy does that for all kinds of reasons.
But it began a long time before we started to recognize globalization and all the rest. I was thinking when I looked at the illustrations in the book, I kept looking at what I think of as pattern recognition. We have this whole other way of perceiving the world, which is visual, and we see patterns. We respond to routine. We respond to systems. And more that kind of pattern recognition is part of our lives. But that was going on in a way, in a subtle way, with the designs that were passing not just from England, but within the communities themselves, within the state or the region.
And the way that these patterns are passed along changes over time, just as our society changed. So you might just, early on, you might have some patterns would be known locally. You can take a look at like New York quilts and say, oh, here we go. We don't have any here. And today we call one of these patterns Happy Hands. Well, we don't have any Happy Hands quilts. They look a little bit like a cross between a palm tree and a Muppet hand. They're just this funny little design. But that's something that's just doesn't come to Maine. It stays in sort of New York. And here in Maine, there's certain things that I recognize that are probably Maine. And if you get enough of these together, then I can tell you that I will put money on that being a Maine quilt. So cut corners, as we call them, which is not, they weren't cut, they were never put there, but the bottom corners of a quilt would be omitted. And that would be so that you could put it onto a bed that had bedposts and it wouldn't get all bunched up. And that's something that happens all over northern New England. But Mainers, I think they clinged to it because I suspect that they still had those old-fashioned four-poster beds for a much longer time, whether it was because it was more rural here, people were more frugal here, people were more conservative here, combination thereof, I don't know. But that lingers in Maine. Talked earlier about the album quilts of the 1840s. Well, at the heart of where these album quilts come from is Maryland. And in that area, those designs are exquisite and they're very well thought out and they're very consistent. It turns out they're buying them basically as kits from certain designers or reacting to those kits. And up here, an album quilt is sort of just a bunch of women who get together and they do whatever design they want to do and then they put it together. And sometimes there'll be a minimum amount of organization. So there's, you know, we'll have the stars in the middle and then the flowers up that side. And usually it's just they all get thrown together, no kind of layout, completely haphazard. And that's another main thing. There's another technique called potholder, which today we call a potholder quilt, or it's a type of quilt as you go. It was not called that then. And in that case, it's again another album quilt usually, but each block is its own mini quilt. So if you have a group of 20 women, they each make a block, but instead of just handing the organizer this quilted this top block, they would take it and make it into a little quilt. They'd find the backing, they would quilt it, and then they would bind it, and then they would give it to the organizer. Mm-hmm. And that's a great idea, except for one thing, which is that there's always somebody in the group who goes, oh, you wanted 11 and a half inches? I thought you wanted 11 inches. So there's always, a lot of times those have, they kind of ripple, they don't lie very flat, because there's always one or two that don't get the message right. But that's another very main sort of thing.
Can you recognize a hand? Could you recognize, look at a quilt and say, well, that's Ethel?
I could not.
From Bethel?
I could not tell if Ethel from Bethel had done that, because most of the motifs, I might be able to start seeing motifs and recognize that, this is Mid-Coast and a lot of these motifs are the same. But I couldn't tell you if Ethel from Bethel made them all, or if Ethel and her sister and her aunt and her brother and her brother's wife in the next town over, if they all liked this motif and made it. So I couldn't get to an individual on that. But sometimes you can tell if more than one person worked on the quilting, because let's say person A, they are very precise and they have very fine, even stitches, and person B is 12 years old, and person C is 75 and doesn't have glasses. And so you can see that different people were involved in different stages of that.
So you can read the makers.
Yes, you can. But I can't identify them.
Mm-hmm. Let's circle back and talk about indigenous quilts,
yes.
The Wabanaki tradition.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, you have pieces in the museum.
We do.
There is a long tradition. It's in some ways very different. There are lots of similarities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Wabanaki artists, and there's no other word but artists, made the most exquisite applique work I have ever seen. Applique means you're applying a design to the surface of your block. And so Wabanakis didn't make bed quilts, but they made clothing that had applique on it. And this applique incorporated beadwork in many cases. And the motifs that they used had embedded within them clues to the identity of the maker. So a Penobscot would make what's called a double curve, two circles that come together in the middle and come back toward each other. A Penobscot artist would make her double curve a certain way, and a Passamaquoddy would make it a different way, and a Maliseet and a Mi'kmaq. It's hard for me to tell the difference between Maliseet and Passamaquoddy, but Mi'kmaqs were they have what looks like a little golf tee in the middle. Sorry, that's not a very polite way to put it, but graphically you can imagine that shape, I think, better than any other description, in the middle of their double curve. And so by taking a look at these pieces, you can sometimes tell who made it. Maybe not the individual who made it, but certainly what group they belong to. Mm-hmm. And when I say that this applique work is the finest I've ever seen, keep in mind that some of it includes beads, glass beads. And some of this applique is narrower than the width of a glass bead. The base of it is wool broadcloth, a nice finished wool, sort of, it's been shrunken a little bit, so it's nice and dense and it's very warm. And then the applique work is in silk, and so they're taking silk ribbons and they're cutting them with great accuracy and then turning the edges under and sewing them down and then adding some beads. It's just exquisite.
Were these utilitarian pieces or mostly ceremonial?
Yes, they were both. Some of them were definitely special occasion clothing, but some of them were used all the time. For example, we have in the museum's collection a piece that is phenomenal for two reasons. One is it's a beautiful woman's cap. They call them peaked caps because they come up to a peak behind the head. And it's very unusual that you know who made a piece. Usually that information's lost. We know who made it. And then even more unusual, there are photographs of her when she was very old, wearing this piece that she probably made in the 1790s. So we know who made it. We know that she wore it her whole life. And chances are that means she wore it on special occasions only because the silk's not going to hold up that long. So in that case, yes, I think a lot of them are special occasion.
Fairly old to actually be captured in a photograph.
Yes.
When you think it's made in and she the 1790s yeah, and
yes,
now in the
1860s,
1870s.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And there's other things that we have. There's one another piece that we have that there's a photograph of a young boy who take it in 1890, and he's wearing some of this. But these pieces were probably from the 1830s to 1850s, somewhere in there. And they're almost identical. So in the case of that piece, we can say this was made by the same hand as made the piece that he's wearing. It's the same hand.
And were those replicated in any way? I mean, did other people wear them? Did it become, was it an individual statement, or were there something that they could be made and used by others for other purposes?
The pieces that were very ornate, like this piece we've just described that this boy was wearing, those were generally made by men who were high up in the organization. So the governor, lieutenant governor, and some of the higher elders and things. And the Penobscots, man, they had it figured out. They realized pretty early on that really what they need to do is to make these on panels that then you can just tack onto a coat. Because if you think about it, a lot of men, a lot of women too, expand a bit as they age. And
I wouldn't know.
No, none of us would know. Mm. But I hear that's what happens.
I hear,
And the other thing, of course, is that you get moths get into things and people trip and fall and catch something on a nail and all that kind of thing. So when you've put hundreds of hours in, there's a contemporary artist whose name is Jennifer Neptune, and she got a grant to make a replica of one of these chief's collars, as we call them. And it took her 300 hours to make this. Mm. And she was using ribbon that was commercially purchased and actually had a selvage on each side. So she didn't have as many hours of turning as her ancestor had to make this piece. And that still took her 300 hours. So if you're going to put 500 hours into an article of clothing, it makes perfect sense to have it be on a panel that then can change as a person ages or if a person dies and we can give it to their descendant. So they were worn over time, but they were mostly worn for special occasions.
I had the privilege of traveling with Jennifer Neptune in Greenland. And we went into a woman's social circle, a costume revival or institute in one of the in the towns. I don't remember if it was in Nuuk or Sisimiut or something like that. And I just watched her sit with the women, and there was this kind of immediate identification. It was as if they just all that their fingers, there was a little lightning bolt that went between their fingers, and they just knew right away. And she was immediately comfortable, and they were immediately comfortable, and there was this conversation, and I just wanted that moment to carry on. And I've also seen Jennifer's baskets, which of course are
extraordinary. They're wonderful. Yeah. If I may, I want to define the word costume because there are different meanings to that word. And if you're a historian or a museum person, when you say costume, you don't mean Halloween. So there's two aspects to clothing. One is the aspect that keeps you warm or keeps you cool, that physical part of clothing, that's clothing. But there's also a social aspect to clothing. You're conveying messages, even though we're not conveying the same messages and as discrete messages as the Wabanaki were using in the early 1800s, we still convey a message with whatever we wear. For example, today I'm in a studio. It really doesn't matter much what I wear. I can wear blue jeans. No one's going to see me. But I'm not going to wear the same clothes I wear to garden as I am to go to a wedding, most likely. So those are so when we talk about costume, we're talking about the social messages inherent in the clothing that's being made, for a social reason.
Some of us wear the same costume every day.
Yeah, a lot of us do. I love Maine for that. I just love it.
Exactly. It's consistent.
Yes.
There's a certain consistency to the spirit of Maine, so there are no surprises.
And Jennifer is now involved. She's doing more applique work, yeah. And more artists are starting to pick it up. It's very exciting.
That is very exciting. The renewal.
Yes.
And in one or two people. You know, there's a family there and there's a tribal tradition and all the rest of it, but still there's an individual artist's hands at work and there's a design intuition as well. And then there's the astounding competency of it all.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about technology. There was a big change when we began to machine cloth.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that and contextualize it for what happened later in the 18th, 19th century?
Well, in terms of technology, there are a number of parallel things that happen. And one of them is that the change in technology, the change in manufacturing, it started a huge change in Maine physically and demographically. Mills spread up the river. People had to come in to work in those mills. First it was farm girls, then it was more immigrants from Canada, and then became immigrants from other places. People from all over the world wound up coming to Maine and Massachusetts, of course, too, to work. And what happens in Maine when suddenly there is a lot more cotton printed fabric available and you don't have to import it? So that price is kind of knocked off a little bit. It's going to be a little bit cheaper. And then when the technology starts, meaning that it can be made more efficiently, I won't say that all of those savings are passed on to the consumers, of course, but some of them are. So fabric becomes cheaper and more plentiful. Designs become available, and what you see is you see more quilts, you see an increase in the different patterns, you see an increase in the amount of fabrics that are used. There's a myth that says that people reused all their fabric. They saved every little scrap, and to a certain extent, yes, people did save some scraps, but often they just bought new fabric, just like we do today. And I wonder if some of that is an outgrowth of what was happening in our grandmother's memories in terms of fabric from that was used during the Depression or something. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So the quilts reflect this change of manufacturing. And then, of course, after the Civil War, it seems often that the needs of war will trigger mechanical and manufacturing improvements. Mm-hmm. And so in this case, the sewing machine became much more popular and much more used, especially once they figured out that you could put money down and then just keep paying for it. All of a sudden, it became available to a lot more women. And that meant that they had more time available to sew other things other than clothing. And so here again, post-war, mills that had shifted to make wartime goods like tents and that sort of thing, they're back to making printed cottons. And so we've got many more fabrics available, new colors available, some phenomenal new printing techniques available, which meant that things are just flying through the mills faster than ever. And it means that you have an explosion of types of quilts and patterns, new designs, new patterns, new fabrics. And if you look at pretty much any museum in the United States, at least in the Northeast United States, you will see that the bulk of their collection of quilts will probably be between 1875 and 1900, because they were really popular. It was a big deal.
Were they commercial quilts?
Not for the most part, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Here, certainly not.
Right. The Civil War was key. There are many, many Civil War quilts in the collection, I think. You have a whole chapter in the book about the Civil War quilt.
We do have a whole, and we only have two quilts in our collection.
Really?
From the Civil War. Actually, most of the Civil War quilts that were produced were used up. We have one quilt in the collection that was acquired by somebody who didn't know fabrics and didn't know quilt styles very well. So it came to us, and the story was that this was a man who had been injured, and his wife took the train down with this quilt to cover him up and then brought him home on the train. And the family has treasured this quilt because it was their ancestor, who was a hero, had been wrapped in this quilt. Well, that quilt was not made until the 1890s. Hmm. And the chances are that somewhere that family has a ratty old quilt that's got stains on it and holes in it, and that's probably the quilt from the Civil War, because it was used on somebody's bed, and sooner or later has to get washed, and sooner or later it gets used up.
But there are themes. There are Civil War themes.
Absolutely.
There's certainly examples of patriotism. There are a lot of patriotic American flag themes. That seems to be a recurring kind of motif that goes through and through.
And I love the expression of the flag in the 19th century, because nobody worried about what the stars looked like, how big the canton, that's the blue bit, how big that was. They're so expressive and they're so creative and they're definitely folky, and we have a lot of flags on quilts.
If you are just joining us, this is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors and artists who invoke the spirit of Maine, broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio 89.9 FM, streaming and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Lori Labar, recently retired curator at the Maine State Museum and author of Maine Quilts, 250 Years of Comfort and Community, published in 2021 by Down East Books. We're discussing quilts and quilting as craft and social engagement, invoking the spirit of Maine. There's psychology in quilts, it would seem to me, that one could imagine in the psyche of the maker something that would dictate or determine the theme. Patriotism might be one. And then I came across the crazy quilt, which in fact is a portrait of neurotic psyche that is just absolutely delightful. And it seems like there was an idea that was legitimized that you could do anything. And in any pattern whatsoever, without any logic whatsoever, including any emotion that you wanted to contribute. Talk about the crazy quilt.
I have a love-hate relationship with crazy quilts because somebody will call and say, I have this quilt and it is gorgeous. Wait till you see it. And I'm like, oh God, here comes another crazy quilt. They're beautiful. But I mean, there's a motto with crazy quilts, and that motto is nothing exceeds like excess. So in a classic, like 1890s crazy quilt, you have your silk, you have your velvet. I've counted as many as 17 different embroidery stitches just covering the seams, because every seam is hidden by embroidery stitches. So 17 different embroidery stitches just covering the seams. In the really busy ones, every single patch of fabric that goes into a crazy quilt is itself embellished. So it might have embroidery, it might have painting, it might have sequins on it, it might have little metal doodahs on it. I mean, it's just insane.
They seem without logic altogether.
Oh, yeah. They're crazy. They really are. And, you know, we think, too, a lot of times people think, oh, the 1800s, oh, my gosh, those poor people. The fabric was just so, everything was boring. It was all browns. Well, let me tell you, the 1830s were crazy, too. Those colorways were sort of, think 1968 to 1974. That's kind of like the 1830s in terms of the colorways. It's just insane. And then you don't get that level of whoa until crazy quilts. And the patterns that I was talking about just after the Civil War, a lot of those patterns require very precise stitching and very careful piecing. And you have to really plan things out. This is where your math comes in handy, ladies, because, of course, it was mostly ladies that were doing it. And so for women who didn't have to do a lot of math in their school, I mean, let me tell you, they did a lot of math and quilting, trying to fit all these things in. And so I also wonder if perhaps one of the things that made a crazy quilt so intriguing was the fact, like, no, we don't have to measure. We can do whatever we want here. We don't have to make sure that every one of these little logs of this log cabin lines up, because otherwise it's going to look funny. We can just go.
There's no order.
There's none. And yet, it's sort of like those people where everybody wants to be an individual just like everybody else. Because a lot of these quilts, even though there's not any order, they mostly look pretty much the same when you're all done with said.
No, but not when you look closely.
Not when you look closely, but if you put it across the room, a lot of them look very, very similar. Mm-hmm. And some of that, of course, is the colorways that are available at a certain time. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with fashion and what's popular. But and then in Maine, they continue to be made. Well, people still make them today. But they get made in more, they start to be made not just in the silks and velvets, but they also start to be made in wool and in cotton and in less precious fabrics. And in terms of the silks, a lot of Maine women didn't have that access to silks. And so they would, but the ladies' magazines would have advertisements, and you could send away for silk scraps so that you'd have enough silk to make your crazy quilt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I like that line, everybody wants to be an individual just like everybody else. There's a lot of sociology in that in that line.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the 21st century quilt. Is there a revival?
Absolutely. After World War II, there was a real dearth of quilts. I think part of it had to do with those bad old days when we needed to use our scraps to make quilts during the Depression. And part of it probably was that sort of mid-century modern kind of feel where we're moving into an exciting new period and quilts belong to the past. So I don't know if those were playing into it, but my hunch is that was the case. And so quilts didn't start to come back again until the late 60s and 70s, when we had the centennial of the Civil War and then the bicentennial coming up. And suddenly people were quilting again. And they have never stopped. And they have definitely moved into the future, as it were.
There was the famous AIDS quilt, for example.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Are there lots of those, remnants of those, or was that a single phenomenon? But are those kinds of quilts in your collection?
There's a wonderful set of quilts that were comparable, but much smaller, because the AIDS quilt, each block is huge. It's like 4 feet by 8 feet or something. It's really very big. But these were smaller. They were only a couple feet wide by a foot. And they were made, something similar was made all over the country. And these were made as a protest for nuclear weapons. So that did continue to be done. Today, there's all kinds of quilts that are made for different causes, and sometimes they're in celebrations of things, and sometimes they're in protests of things, but they don't tend to be as highly organized as those two, the maids' quilts and this other quilt, both of which were from started in the 80s and the 90s.
How do you feel about the exhibit of the ladies of Gies Bend?
Gies Bend, they're beautiful quilts. Oh, my goodness, they're stunning. But I don't know enough about it. There's some history there of early on people being taken advantage of. Mm. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. But the most recent ones, it's a celebration.
Formative understanding or investment in those quilts that had been made by these ladies for a long, long time without recognition. Mm-hmm. And they are absolutely exquisite as pieces of art. Mm-hmm. But suddenly they were patronized and made famous.
Yeah. And there's also an idea that that quilts tend to be anonymous, crazy quilts being the exception. Families didn't necessarily value a quilt. And I think it's because mom made it, you know? I mean, how wonderful can it be? Mom made it, which is a horrible thing to say, but I think that's kind of the attitude that came around. And then in the 70s and 80s, they started to be valued as art pieces, but they, of course, were anonymous. So now I'm very glad that people are starting to label their quilts.
They're signing their quilts.
They're recognizing that this is, in fact, something that you're spending hundreds of hours on is, in fact, an art form.
Does Maine have examples of that type of artistry?
Absolutely. The book and the exhibit were supposed to happen at the same time. And then, of course, COVID happened. And then, of course, we lost our HVAC system. So the exhibit will be opening now when we reopen in 2025. And the quilts, the earliest quilt that we will have in our collection has fabrics from the 1750s, was probably made a couple decades later. And the most recent quilt that will be in the exhibit so far anyway, unless something wonderful turns up real soon, was made in 2019.
Do you quilt?
I do, but I didn't. When I started this book, I did not quilt. And I got asked to be part of an exhibit of something called a study quilt, which is where you study an antique quilt or whatever the rules of this particular study group is, and you make a one-quarter size, you riff on it. It doesn't have to be an absolute mirror of it. It can be something where you just take one of the motifs and go with it or whatever. So I got asked to do that, and I said, sure, without thinking. And it wasn't until later that I'm like, oh, not only do I have to make a quilt, I have to make a quilt that's good enough to go in a show. What was I thinking? And I pulled it off, and I loved it.
Well, now you've got time, and you have this vast library of referential information.
I do. Oh, man.
You're assigned.
You are assigned
to make a number of quilts. There's nothing left for you to do but quilt after quilt, quilt after quilt.
I'm working on a paper right now, but after I finish that paper.
Forget the paper. The paper is ridiculous. It's just an academic.
Yes, yeah.
You don't have to make those checks anymore.
That's right.
Anymore.
I have this one. I want to get this one done. I really do.
So we're coming close to the end, and one of the challenges of this program is, you know, we're talking about invoking the spirit of Maine. Well, what in the world does that mean? What is the spirit of Maine? Your book title, however, mm-hmm. provided me some insight. So it's 250 years, a long historical span in which a spirit is developed and defined and made real, of comfort and community. Mm-hmm. And that link is extremely insightful if you start to think about the values that unite us as Mainers across many, 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 many levels of application. The community part is one thing. Comfort can be defined as something as simple as putting a warm quilt over you
mm-hmm.
on a cold night.
Exactly.
But it also is it's also security.
Mm-hmm.
It's also well-being. Mm-hmm. It's also a good harvest. It's also all of those kinds of things that are built into it, in which then a quilt, a modern quilt or a historical quilt, becomes not only it becomes both symbol and reality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there is a whole network, well, it's not a whole network. There's a network of networks out there of mostly women, but some men as well, making quilts now. And you can only make so many quilts for your own needs, because how many beds do you have anyway? How many kids with how many beds do you have? And a lot of women who love quilts and love to make quilts and love it for them, for quilting, for the sort of meditative parts of it, and the way that it connects you to the past and all these other reasons. People who love quilts for whatever reason, they wind up making quilts for others, for communities, for kids, not only just the locals, which has always been done, which is, oh, you know, here in East Overshoe Falls, the Smith family lost their home to a fire. We're going to make them a quilt, as well as take anything out of the attic that we don't want. But they also make them for babies who are born too early, or for kids overseas who are about to have surgery, all kinds of reasons. It's a wonderful, wonderful network. One of the things that I discovered making this is that as I looked through from the late 1700s all the way to the early 2100s, is that there's actually sort of three types of quilts that are being made. One is people who make traditionalists, people who make quilts because they want something on their bed and they want something that reminds them of days past and is pretty. Then there's people who are sort of neo-traditionalists, who are experimenting with some of the old techniques or the old motifs, but they're expressing them in a very modern way. And then there's art quilters. And the term art quilt didn't even happen until the late 1900s. That term didn't exist. But it was always there. So because we've seen these patterns for so long, we don't realize just how avant-garde some of them were at the time, and how there have always been Mainers who have wanted to quilt not to make a bed quilt so much, but as an expression of their feelings or their artistry or their creativity.
Right there. Well, we see it in artists today.
Yeah.
We see it in the galleries. We see art that just simply meets our expectations.
Mm-hmm.
The Lobster Boat, the that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Distant Island. But then there are these other explosions of sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep thinking about the creative economy in Maine. And we have, as part of that, a kind of a historical engagement with craft.
Mm-hmm.
We make things in Maine.
We do.
And that's part of it. We also invent things in Maine. So a quilt becomes a scape for just that kind of thing, you see, and it allows us to express ourselves in a way that then has a penultimate utility, you know. Oh, I'm cold, I'll put on the quilt. And also the gift of touch, of hand, yeah, that you make a quilt for somebody else, mm-hmm, and you give it to it. That's an unforgettable gift.
It is an unforgettable gift. And Mainers are so, overall, we're a really pragmatic lot. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not surprised that there's so many women, especially women, who spend their creative energies on something that's also practical. Mm-hmm. And not just practical physically, but practical emotionally as well, as all those things that connect with a quilt.
Well, I think we've captured it. We've made our own little crazy quilt here for an hour of conversation about culture, acculturation, comfort, community in Maine. It's been delightful.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
I'd like to commission a quilt from your new career as a quilter. I think there should be you should evoke the pointed furs.
Well, I think I will. The quilt I'm working on right now is in memory of my mother, and it evokes where her heart lay, which was in Montana. And on the left, there's the mountain she could see from the front yard, and on the back, the one from the backyard. But the next quilt I do will be for me.
I think it would be interesting to go back and reread Sarah Orne Jewett before you do.
Oh, I do love it.
Because I suspect that there's quilting in that narrative.
And you know, I haven't read it since before I started working on the quilts. The last time I read it was when I was working on At Home in Maine, so it's time to reread it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
My guest today has been Lori Labar, retired curator at the Maine State Museum and author of Maine Quilts, 250 Years of Comfort and Community, published in 2021 by Down East Books. Sarah Orne Jewett published her American classic, The Country of the Pointed Furs, in 1896, and it has remained a quiet evocation of the best of Maine. In a special edition published by Simon & Schuster, it is described as follows. It tells the story spanning 3 months' time in the life of a small coastal town called Dunnet Landing in 19th century Maine. A lone female visitor arrives and finds lodging with the widowed Mrs. Todd, the town herbalist, who introduces the visitor to many of the town's inhabitants. The visitor's impressions of the people she meets start out simply, and then almost invisibly they crescendo into a deep, intense human portrait. When I read this book, I am moved by the wisdom hidden in the simplicity of the story. The portraits of the people, the likes of whom are today my friends and neighbors, known and unknown. For Jewett, the place described is a best scape for living, in nature, at work, for community. It is a place to see, hear, smell, taste, feel, love, and celebrate the best of what we call home. At the end, Jewett writes, near the woods, we could walk along to the highest point. There above the circle of pointed firs, we could look down over all the island and could see the ocean that circled this and 100 other bits of island ground, the mainland shore and all the horizons. It gave a sudden sense of space, for nothing stopped the eye or hedged one in. That sense of liberty and space and time, which great prospects always give. What a perfect definition of the spirit of Maine. Thanks for listening to Conversations from the Pointed Furs. I'm Peter Neal.
You've been tuned in to Conversations from the Pointed Furs, a Leeds Island Books audio project, produced by Tricia Badger, theme by Casey Neal for Mock Turtle Music. Hosted by Peter Neal. Visit pointedfurs.org for more information and find us on your favorite podcast app.